we'll discuss from the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, verses 1, 2 and 3. So the chapter 7 in the Bhagavad Gita is called as Knowledge of the Absolute. Knowledge of the Absolute in Sanskrit is called as Jnana Vijnana Yoga. So I will tell the translations of the first three verses, and then we will discuss the topic we are discussing today is the uniqueness of Krishna conscious wisdom. The uniqueness of Krishna conscious wisdom. So 7.1 states, मय्यासक्तमनः पार्थ योगं युञ्जन् मदाश्रयः असंशयं समग्रं मां यथा ज्ञास्यसि तच्छृणु. He says that by hearing about me, you will become free from doubts, you will understand me in full, you will gain shelter of me, and in this way you will become attached to me. So in this one verse, Lord Krishna is talking about six things. The first thing is actually what comes last in the verse. Tat shrunu. Hear about me. By hearing about me, what will happen? Asamshayam samagram maam. You will get knowledge about me. Samagram maam. You will get complete knowledge about me. And when you get knowledge about me, the third thing that will happen, that is asamshayam. You will become free from doubts. When you become free from doubts, what will happen the next thing? Mad ashrayaha. You will want to take shelter of me. When we get knowledge about Krishna, we want to take shelter of Krishna. And when, how do we take shelter of Krishna? For that we practice yoga. Yogam yunjan. And when we practice yoga, what will be the fruit of that yoga? Maya satta manaha. We will become attached to Krishna. Or more specifically, our mind will become attached to Krishna. So, you know, hearing is a very important part of learning, whether it is material knowledge or it is spiritual knowledge. In our colleges, we go and study, basically we hear from the professors. Similarly, in Krishna consciousness, we hear from the spiritual master and the spiritual master's representatives. So, the first point is relatively easy to understand. Hearing gives us knowledge. But, in Krishna consciousness, the hearing doesn't give just an intellectual knowledge. You see, when we talk about hearing, we are not just talking about a process of knowledge information transfer. Just like sometimes in school, small children, they memorize tables. So 2 2's are 4, and the student also replies 2 2's are 4, 2 2's are 4, 2 2's are 4. That is mere information transfer. But essentially, when we hear from a devotee, it is not just information transfer, but it is consciousness transfer. It is not just information transfer, but consciousness transfer. Consciousness transfer means desires transfer. So Srila Prabhupada went and preached in the West. Before him, so many other people had written commentaries on the Gita. But by reading those commentaries, nobody became a devotee. Why? Because the writer of the commentary, the speaker in the Gita, himself was not devoted to Krishna. He had no desire to serve Krishna. He had no Krishna consciousness. And so naturally he could not produce any Krishna consciousness in the readers. So, when we talk about the knowledge of Krishna consciousness, that knowledge is meant for a purpose. That purpose is to transform our hearts, to transform our desires. And an important part of that is asamshayam. We become free from doubts. So now, we may have different kinds of doubts. some doubts, they'll be very basic. Does God exist, first of all? Or why should Krishna be God? There are so many other people who might be God. Or did Krishna really marry so many queens? How could he have lived? There are different kinds of doubts which are there. So, when you talk about these doubts, it is very important to get all of them clarified over a period of time. And the way we get them clarified varies. So, I'll analyze four kinds of doubts. The first is the kind of doubts which are clarified as soon as we hear the philosophy. For example, some of us may have already experienced to some extent how life in this world is a misery. How repeatedly there are frustrations, there are problems, there are disappointments. And we feel that this is the way the world is. But everybody around us is telling us, no, this world is a wonderful place, this world is an enjoyable place, and we can be happy here. So, this kind of doubt is something which will get cured by the hearing of Krishna conscious philosophy. That means, as soon as we hear, for example, somebody tells us, one of Srila Prabhupada's senior disciples, Ravindra Swarup Prabhu, he wrote how, as soon as he heard the devotee speaking, this world is a place of misery, he felt at last there is somebody who is ready to tell the truth, who is not just bluffing. Yes, this world is miserable, that's what I have experienced. And at last somebody is ready to speak that directly, face on. Somebody is not just bluffing, but they're telling, this is the truth. So I'm sending you a PowerPoint presentation right now, which is possible, after you receive it, you can open it and we will discuss based on that. You will receive it, you can just accept it. So, the first kind of doubt is where we hear and immediately say, this makes sense. And the second category will be, we may hear, but we may wonder, how is this true? For example, we hear that it is not the body, it is the soul that is the source of life. Then we may have some doubts. But actually when the body gets damaged and the person dies, that would be seem to indicate that the body is the source of life and not something different from the body. So then we understand that actually the body is like a vehicle. So if a vehicle is damaged, that does not mean the driver is necessarily damaged, because the driver wants to move from one place to another. So when the vehicle is damaged, he leaves the vehicle and goes to some other place. So like that, some doubts, we have some analysis, some question answer, some discussion, and then those doubts get cleared. The third category is when we practice Krishna consciousness for several years, we become purified, and after we become purified, then we understand how this particular thing is true. So for example, Krishna's dealings with the gopis. Now at first glance, they may appear to be mundane. It's just like a boy-girl dealing. Although Prabhupada and Acharyas repeatedly tell us that they are not. But that's what they will appear to be to us. So, when we purify our hearts, after purifying our hearts, we understand that actually, This is something entirely different. In fact, the Bhagavad Gita tells us that this world is like a reflection of the spiritual world. Urghamulam adhashakam ashwantam prahuravgayam. Chandamsi asya paranani astam vedasa vedavit. In 15.1, Lord Krishna says that this world is like an upside down reflection of the spiritual world. So, we see the male-female relationship in this world. And that is a reflection of the original, pure, spiritual male-female relationship between Krishna and the gopis. So the reflection gives an understanding of the reality. But the reflection is not the reality. Now in all the different religions of the world, there is a great mystery about the origin of the male-female attraction. Now, all religions which are genuine spiritual searches for God warn that attraction to the opposite sex will distract one from spiritual life. And therefore they tell that one should curb or stop or at least regulate this attraction. But the other religious traditions fail to explain where does this attraction come from? Why is there an attraction at all between male and female? So nowadays in the West, where Christianity is the predominant religion, wherever people are religious, many people are mostly atheistic or agnostic. Atheistic means they don't believe in God. Agnostic means they feel that God can't be known, so let's not make any judgment about this. So, those people who do believe in some sort of God, there is an aggressive feminist wing in Christianity which says, why should God be male? Why should God be male? Why can't God be a female? And therefore, these people, there are sects within Christianity which have changed the Bible. So wherever God is referred to as a he, they have changed he to she. So she said, Oh Father, the standard prayer, Oh Father, thou art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. They say, why there should be a father? Why not mother? A mother is said to be more loving than the father. Oh Mother, thou art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. And they have gone further, and in New York, they have made a big image of Jesus Christ. They say, if God is a person, why should God be male? Why can't God be female? And if God has sent a messenger to us, God has sent his offspring to us, then why does that person have to be a male? Why can't that person be a female? So they have made an image, an idol of Jesus as a female, complete with breasts and hips and female reproductive organs. So this is complete misunderstanding about God's nature, where we superimpose our ideas on God. Now, of course, now we should not just condemn Christianity, because even what we call as Hinduism is also not much behind. Now, recently I had gone to Jamshedpur. We have a NIT there. So, Jamshedpur has the world's first and only Madhuri Dixit temple, where there is one person who has made a temple of Madhuri Dixit. And in Calcutta, there are 12 temples of Amitabh Bachchan. And they are called as Kaliyug ke Ram ka Mandir. Kaliyug ke Ram ka Mandir. So the idea is here that in the West as well as in India, people are dragging their own conceptions on God. So I am a female, so God should be a female. Now God is somebody who attracts me, so I am attracted to a particular movie star, whether a female or a male. So I will make that into a God. Or a goddess, or whatever. That's why the Vedic scriptures tell us very clearly that this world is a reflection. A reflection of the spiritual world. So, why is it important to understand that it is a reflection? Because there is a difference between the reflection and the reality. The reflection indicates the existence of the reality, but the reflection is not the reality. If I see a delicious mango in a river, then to get the mango, I have to do two things. You know, there are two fundamental misconceptions which obstruct us from attaining real spiritual happiness. The first is materialism, second is impersonalism. So what is this? Let's continue with this example of a reflection. So if there is a mango tree on the banks of a river, and that mango tree is reflected in the river, then we see a reflection of the mango in the river. So materialism says that that reflected mango is real. That reflected mango is real, so jump in and catch it and eat it and enjoy it. And if you jump in and try to catch it, and when you just, all that we get when you jump in, just we bang our head against the rock below the surface of the river and we get wounded. So yehi samspashya bhoga dukkha yonaya evate. When we try to enjoy the senses, all that we get is misery. So materialism is the idea that the reflection is the reality, that the mango is there in the reflection itself, and therefore jump down and enjoy it. And you know, we have governments which make 5-year plans, 10-year plans, 1-year plans. So that is like a group of people coming together. Okay, we'll make a 5-year plan to find the reflection, find the mango in the river. Now how much exhaustively we search, how much comprehensively search, how much scientifically we search, we are not going to find the mango in the reflection, because it is not there. So scientific and technological progress may be useful in the sense that it may provide us with more comforts, physically speaking, but it does not lead to happiness. What is the difference between comfort and happiness? Comfort is related with the body, whereas happiness is a state of mind and it is a state of the heart. Comfort is related with the body. That means, imagine if you are doing some project in computer science and you are working in an AC lab, and summer it's very hot, so when you go to the AC lab you feel very cool and comfortable as compared to the outside sultriness and heat. But at the same time, if you have a project guide or a boss who is very tyrannical and he's chastising you, although you've not done anything wrong, he's chastising you. So you may be physically comfortable, but are you happy? No, you are miserable, because although you are physically in an AC room, you are not happy, because physical comfort is different from happiness. So science and technology may make us physically more comfortable, but it cannot make us happy, because science only deals with the bodily level. So that's why we see in modern times, people are comfortably miserable. People are comfortably miserable. Comfortably miserable means what? They live a lot of comfort, still they are bored, still they are miserable. Just like a person working in a software job, now he has AC. So he will not sweat because of heat, but still he sweats because of stress. So it's a person's software job, a high demanding job, is sweating not because of heat, but he's sweating because of stress. So he's comfortably miserable. So I was talking about these two different misconceptions. The first is materialism, which says that the reflection itself is the reality. And the second is impersonalism, which says the reflection is false and there is no reality. The reflection is false, there is no mango over there, and stop pursuing the mango. And the moment you give up your desires, you will become happy. So impersonalism has the idea that one thing it gets correct is that when we get attracted to material forms, we get attracted to by material desires, then those lead to suffering. How do they lead to suffering? Simple. If we get attracted to some food, we eat a lot of it, and then we get over indigestion. Are you able to hear me? Okay. So we get indigestion. We eat a lot and we get indigestion. Or some people smoke and they get lung cancer and things like that. So when we enjoy our senses, are you able to hear me, Prabhu? Are you able to? Yes, you are able to hear me?
Yes,
Prabhuji. Okay.
Very good.
Okay, thank you. So the impersonalists get one thing right, that the more we enjoy, the more we will suffer. But the other thing that they get wrong is that, therefore, all that we have to do is give up the desire to enjoy. But giving up the desire to enjoy is impossible, because we live for enjoyment. If there is no pleasure, there is no meaning for life. You see, all of us, when problems come in our life, we feel irritated. For example, we are going to college and our cycle punctures. We feel irritated. Or we try to do a project submission and it doesn't work, we feel irritated. Somebody finds some faults with it. But our goal of life, if we look at it seriously, our goal of life is not to live a problem-free life, but to live a purposeful life. Our goal is not to live a problem-free life, but to live a purposeful life. Let's look back at our life. Sometimes after the exams get over, and then we have 1, 2, 3 months vacation. And during those vacations, we have practically no problem. You know, we don't have any exam tension, we don't have any workload, we don't have any deadlines. And 2 months we think, I'll just relax. But generally if we think of it, within 10-15 days we get bored with the vacation. What am I going to do? Whole day watch TV or just fool around? And maybe when we come back after 2 months, back to college, I feel I wasted those 2 months. So we led a problem-free life, but actually in the problem-free life, we did not get any satisfaction. On the other hand, if we look back at our life, there's some time when we were inspired by some purpose. For example, we had a very tough project to do, and we had a tight deadline to meet, and we worked very hard. Constantly working, not wasting any time, thinking about how to deal with the problem, how to solve it, coming up with creative ideas. And although that period was tough, although that period was intense, when now we look back at it, we feel satisfied. Yes, I achieved something in my life at that time. So, if we look at our life, what gives meaning and joy to life is not just being problem-free, but being purposeful. Being problem-free does not give joy to life. It is being purposeful that gives joy to life. So, the impersonalists, they realize that our material desires become the cause of our problem. And therefore they think that if we have to become problem-free, then we have to give up these desires. So they are correct in the sense that we have to give up material desires. But we don't have to give up spiritual desires. Spiritual desires are very, very important for us. And it's only when we develop spiritual desires that we can actually become purified. Become purified and we develop spiritual happiness. So, I was talking about Samagram Gyastasi Asamshayam. We get knowledge about Krishna, and then it becomes free, we become free from doubts. So our doubts fall into two categories. The first category is that this world itself is a place of enjoyment, and second is that there is actually no enjoyment. So all that I want to achieve is shanti, shanti, shanti. But both of them are wrong. So then what happens when we understand this clearly? We are souls, and the soul has an eternal relationship with Krishna. And when that relationship is developed, then one becomes happy. So then what does one want to do? One wants to take shelter of Krishna. Yogam yunjan madashrayaha. So the first step was hearing. Second step was understanding. Third was becoming free from doubts. Fourth is taking shelter of Krishna. When we take shelter of Krishna, what do? We render devotional service to Him. That's the fifth stage. And sixth stage is we fall in love with Krishna. So in the Srimad Bhagavatam 10th canto, there's a beautiful story of how this whole process worked in the life of a great devotee. That is Rukmini Devi. Rukmini Devi is the eternal consort of Lord Sri Krishna in Dwarka. So, she heard about Krishna from Narad Muni. And when she heard about Krishna from Narad Muni, she developed an attraction for Krishna. She felt that Krishna is my greatest well-wisher and I want to attain his shelter. So, you know, these pastimes of Krishna happen repeatedly throughout the different universes. And sometimes the pastime happens slightly differently. So this pastime of Rukmini and Krishna is described in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. And it is also described by Rupa Goswami in his book Lalita Madhava. So there he describes this pastime as it happened in a different yuga, in a different universe, in a different day of Brahma, how it happened. So, Rukmini Devi was the son of, was daughter of King Bhishmaka, who was the king of Vidarbha. Therefore, one name of Rukmini is Vaidehi. Vaidehi means the princess of Vidarbha. And is the capital of Bhishmaka's kingdom was Kundina. So, at that time, Krishna's heroic feats were known far and wide to everyone. And therefore, King Bhishmaka, as well as the citizens of Kundina, felt that their beautiful princess Rukmini will be an ideal match for Krishna. And they wanted that Rukmini should be married to Krishna. But Rukmini had one brother, Rukmi, who was a friend of Shishupal. So Shishupal was also a powerful king, but he was very envious of Krishna. In fact, Shishupal was so envious of Krishna that when he was born, generally a child cries when he is born, but when Shishupal was born, from his birth, he was blaspheming Krishna. Instead of crying, "Krishna, you rascal!" That was the first words he spoke. So, at that time, he actually was born with four hands. So, he was born with four hands and three heads. It was a very peculiar feature. So then, at that time, the astrologers told his mother that his extra hands and his extra heads will fall off when he sees the person who will cause his death. So then, Shishupal and Krishna were related. They are distant relatives, just like Kamsa and Krishna were related. So, they were all more or less related as Kshatriya rulers. So when Krishna came to Sri Shishupal's mother, at that time he saw the baby. And as soon as he saw the baby, two of the heads and two of the arms fell off. And at that time, immediately, Shishupal's mother begged to Krishna, please, don't kill my child. So Krishna said, I have no desire to kill him. But if he does activities which causes contamination, then if he misleads people, if he is envious of people, then I will have to do my duty. But still, because you have asked me for a blessing, I promise you that unless he blasphemes me 100 times, continuously, I will not kill him. So she told Shishupal, you should never blaspheme Krishna. And even if you have to blaspheme him, don't blaspheme 100 times. Once, twice, thrice is enough, but not 100 times. So Shishupal, whenever he would want to blaspheme, he would keep a counter with him. And 1, 2, 3, he would come to 99 and then stop. Not literally, he would not keep a counter, but he would keep a mental counter. So, the Shishupal wrote a letter to Rukmini. And he said, generally the conditioned soul has a very inflated opinion about himself. So he wrote, oh Rukmini, may your attraction to that glorious Shishupal, who is the best of all kings, and whose virtuous qualities fill his father Damaghosh with pride and joy, may your attraction to that Shishupal awaken constantly. So, he said that I am the best of kings and my father loves me so much. Now, Damaghosh was also arrogant like him, envious like him. So, naturally, because both of them were envious, both of them liked each other. So, he wrote a letter. When Rukmini got that letter, she replied to him that I have already given my heart to the cowherd Krishna, who is now the prince of Dwarka, and I will never give my heart to anybody else. So Shishupal became very disappointed and angry by this. And Rukmini heard this. Now Shishupal was a powerful king and Rukmini wanted to make Shishupal into his friend. So Rukmini, because he himself was a powerful prince and King Bhishmaka was attached to his son to some extent, he could not oppose and displease his son. So when Rukmini proposed that Rukmini should be married to Shishupal, Bhishmaka could not refuse. Although nobody else in the family wanted this marriage, Hare Krishna, can you hear me?
Yes, Prasi, very good.
By still, what time should I go on?
Very good again.
Yes, till what time should I go on?
Today is holiday, Prasi.
Okay, yeah, so till 8:30, 8:45 and 9, you tell me. I don't want to take too much of it.
8:45.
Okay. Should we have some time for question answers before that or after that?
After that.
Okay. Thank you.
If you have time.
Okay, okay. So, I was telling about the story of Rukmini. So, because Rukmini was the prince and he was powerful, nobody could displease him. At the same time, nobody was pleased with his proposition. So, Rukmini called for Shishupal to come, and Shishupal, being afraid that Krishna will come and take Rukmini, he brought with him many other princes. He brought Jarasandha, he brought Dantavakra, and he brought all the other demoniac kings who were there. Of course, by this time Kamsa had been killed. So he brought the other kings to Kundina, and huge armies were there. And meanwhile, Rukmini started doing a sacrifice, a yajna, for the pleasure of Chandrabhaga. Chandrabhaga is a form of Durga, to make sure that the marriage of Rukmini and Shishupal will go off successfully. And he pleased the Devi, and the Devi appeared and she gave him a mysterious blessing. She told him, the grandson of Sura, who was born with 4 hands, will certainly become your brother-in-law. The grandson of Sura, who was born with four hands, will become your son-in-law. Now, Surasen, he had many sons. So one of his sons was Vasudev, and through him, the son is Krishna. Another one of his sons was Damaghosh, and through him the son was Shishupal. So now all the devatas, all the demigods and demigoddesses, they are actually servants of Krishna. And they play a role in Krishna's plan only. So Shishupal thought, Rukmi thought, now Devi has promised, so therefore the marriage will be successful. But what had Devi promised? That Sura's grandson, who was born with four hands, will become your son, brother-in-law. Now both Shishupal and Krishna were born with four hands. Isn't it? So Rukmi thought that this referred to Shishupal, but the Devi had referred to Krishna. Then, at that time, Narad Muni came there to again see Rukmini. No, Narad Muni was Rukmini, like the goddess of fortune. And Rukmini told her heart. She said, "And I have given my heart to Krishna and I cannot tolerate being with anybody else." So, at that time, Narad Muni told her that you send a message to Krishna. So then Rukmini wrote a letter. And she gave a letter to a Brahmana named Sunanda. And that Brahmana went from there to Dwarka to inform Krishna. And Sunanda, he rushed from there, and Rukmini wrote very fervently. In Vedic culture, a woman is expected to be shy, chaste, and unassuming, surrendered. So the Vedic culture, or rather the Bhagavat culture, demonstrates both aparadharma and paradharma. What is aparadharma and paradharma? Apara means not transcendental, that is mundane religion. Aparadharma and paradharma is transcendental religion. So, for example, for a woman to be obedient to her Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.
Yes.
For a woman to be obedient to her husband or to her father, to her brother, that is considered to be very important. And unless women are submissive and shy and unassuming, then they get themselves into trouble. If women are not like this, they get themselves into trouble. Nowadays, women want to dress in provocative ways, exposing various parts of their body. And why do they want to do that? They want to do that so that people become attracted to them. And then, of course, if they are exploited, if they are abused, if they are physically violated, then they complain. They say, "These men are so uncontrolled that they do all these crimes against us." But the point here is that they are becoming provocative. So, what the idea is that women feel that we want to dress provocatively, we want to attract men, but men shouldn't touch us. So, it doesn't work like that. Once you start burning a fire, you can't control the fire. Because we ourselves don't know how much lust is in our hearts or in others' hearts. So, once we trigger the lust, then how much the lust will go forward, we don't know. So, it's like if there's a tiger who is lying on the ground, motionless, with eyes closed. Now, there are two possibilities. The tiger is either asleep or the tiger is dead. Now, somebody says, "I want to just find out whether the tiger is asleep or dead, so I will go and pinch the tiger." Now, if we go and pinch the tiger, and what will happen? If the tiger is not dead, he will not just pinch us, He will swallow us. We will be dead. So, what modern society does is, the lust is like a sleeping tiger there in the hearts of all of us. Whether it is men or women. The sleeping tiger there in the heart of all of us. And what modern society does is, we show all these images, people dress in provocative ways, on the television, in the movies, in the ads, there are sexually stimulating images, and all these are like pinching the tiger. So their idea is that, let us pinch the tiger, because there is some excitement. You know, when a person gets sexually stimulated, there is some excitement. You know, when a woman finds that so many boys are being attracted to me, now it gives her a sense of ego. So similarly, when a man feels like I'm like a Casanova, so many girls are attracted to me, it gives him a sense of ego. But actually, once lust is stimulated, we can't control it. Once that sleeping tiger is awakened, you can't tell him, only eat this rice dal sabzi chapati, don't eat me. He can't control like that. Therefore, the Vedic culture is, don't stimulate lust at all. That's why women will always dress in very modest ways, covering their bodies, and not act or speak in ways that provoke the men. Because when men are provoked, it's not only men who get in trouble, it's not only women who get in trouble. Everybody gets into trouble by that. So, the aparadharma for a woman is that she should be obedient to a man. Either that man can be her husband, or it can be her father, or it can be her brother, whoever. And of course, for the man, it's not that he should be the master of his wife. The man is also the servant of the spiritual master. And the spiritual master is the servant of Krishna. So in that way, it's like an engine. Krishna is the engine. It's like a train. Krishna is the engine. The spiritual master is the first bogie. The husband is the second bogie. The wife is the third bogie. The children are the subsequent bogies. So the whole train goes towards Krishna. So this is aparadharma. Aparadharma is